The National Archives podcast series. A session in conversation with Gus Casely Hayford, talking about his recent book, The Lost Kingdoms of Africa, presented by Gus Casely Hayford as part of our Writer of the Month series of talks.
Well, welcome, Gus.
Thank you.
Perhaps before we get on to discussing your book, maybe you could give us your thoughts on the recent events in Mali and what that means for historians like yourself.
Yeah, I was devastated, and I think one of the saddest things is that over the course of 2012, there was a sense that this was going to happen, and the international community were aware of the potentiality of it, that Ansar Dine, this group who were slowly encroaching on Timbuktu, that they had a record of appalling acts of vandalism, that many of the Sufi shrines that they had come across, that they'd destroyed, and that some of those are just so exquisite, and they're made from a kind of clay, which is basically that it's the sandy soil plus one or two other ingredients that are mixed with water and then kind of cast into bricks. And so they are incredibly easy to destroy, but once gone, they are gone. And these shrines, which are dotted across that bit of Mali, that they tell an incredible history that is completely, you know, there's nothing else, there's nothing that is of a similar nature. And so one had a sense that this was going to happen. And as they got further and further south, got closer to this Timbuktu, to this body of more than 750,000 documents that are unrivaled in their importance, that we were all really worried. But my hope is, Timbuktu is a place that rises like a phoenix, and it has happened in the past. And people have, particularly those librarians and archivists who have the family archives, that they have a tradition of burying their collections, of carrying them south when they needed to, but of doing whatever they can to preserve that incredible collection. And my hope is that in a year or 6 months' time, that we can go back and begin to get a sense of how much has been saved, and I hope it is a significant amount. Because every single one of those documents is important in telling the history of that particular part of Africa.
Yeah, well, let's hope that not all of the kingdoms of Africa have been lost. So, turning to your latest book, perhaps you could just tell the audience, for those of whom who don't know, a little bit about your book.
Lost Kingdoms of Africa. It's my attempt, after having travelled for the last 20 years in Africa and just fallen in love with the place. I mean, my family, that I grew up in London. I grew up in Tooting, actually. And my father, he was born in Ghana, and he had come to Britain in the 50s. On our street, growing up in the 70s and 80s, or in the 60s and 70s, that we were then the only black family. And I think what my father was very keen on is on that being as little as a problem as it needed to be. So what he really did was to invest very strongly in us trying to fit in and to assimilate as much of European and particularly British culture as we possibly could. So my history was, you know, it was Tudors and Stuarts, and the Africa that I kind of got to hear about was the Africa on the news. It was kind of seeing those appalling things happening. And I always wanted to, from the very earliest age, to push beyond that sort of that sense of not knowing. And very occasionally, aunts would come and visit, and they'd bring glorious kinds of fabrics and foods into the house, and it would just give me a sense of some of what I was missing. And as soon as I had the opportunity to travel, I did. I got to 16, and I took off, and the place that I visited first was Ghana, and I discovered this whole kind of hinterland, this hidden history behind particularly my father's family that I just hadn't been aware of. And my grandfather was, he was a lawyer and a politician, but he was also a historian, that he had invested a huge amount of time in trying to capture oral histories and to write them down, that he was born almost 100 years before me, and he grew up into a period in which the British were turning the territory around him into a colony. And one of the ways in which he felt that he could respond was by trying to create record, trying to create, to build a kind of history that could respond to the British idea that there was no history, that there was no land law. That was fascinating to me, this idea of a kind of history that was not like the written histories that I'd been aware of, a kind of oral history that was connected to Africa. And what I also found out is that in my family, that we had inherited over generations this role of an Achami. And an Achami in southern Ghana is it translates as he who makes it good for me. And the Achami's role was to be a representative of the king. And the Achami would both argue on behalf of the king, but he would also hold the history. And, you know, it intrigued me that wrapped up into my father's silence was all of this history. And I wanted desperately to try to uncover some of that. And so as soon as I got the chance, as I said, I travelled and, you know, just fell in love with Africa and fell in love with these structures that were designed to draw people together and to hold history. And, you know, many of those are the things that I write about in this book.
And when you first went to Ghana, did it meet your perceptions that you'd had before, or was it different?
It was very different, very, very different indeed. And, you know, I found it at first very alienating. I realised, you know, I was British. But I also realised that I needed to open up a different way of thinking about myself and about history. That there's kinds of linear histories that I'd invested in before that. They seemed incredibly pallid and insipid compared to the sorts of histories that I met there, that they were histories that could actually be invested in. In fact, I brought something along here to show you. My family, they come from a place called Cape Coast, which is right on the coast of Ghana. And it's a place which, it's beautiful, but it has a history which is incredibly troubled, that it's the place where many slaves were sent to the Caribbean from. But the local people, that they affiliated to the British fairly early on, and one of the ways in which they did that was to form military companies which would take to the battlefield alongside the British and try to stymie any of the encroachments from rival territories. And these military companies, that they actually they create this incredible tradition of flag making, one of the sorts of flags. And this is from the 17th century onwards that they begin to build these flags that, you know, are like the sorts of military flags that you might have, you know, fluttering from you know, a company in Britain, a military company, and that they would be, but they weren't used just on the battlefields, that these became documents that people would invest their love, their history in, that they would be flown on special occasions. But in a way, what they have accreted into them is a kind of agglomerated sense of family, of history, of place, of legitimacy, and they became a kind of record, a sort of fluid sort of record into which anyone could feel a part. And what I remember of my aunts coming to visit us was of them unravelling beautiful bits of cloth and using those to tell stories. And it gave me a sense of a kind of history, a kind of record that could complement, but at the same time was parallel to the sort of written record that I I was also very aware of.
So have you seen quite a few of these flags, different?
There are many hundreds of them.
And how are they different?
The symbols on them, that they might be particular incidents that were important to the people. But what, in a way, was critical was that the symbols could become sort of allegorical, that they were lessons. And in a way, that, I think, it's a kind of different sort of history in which one could actually sort of weave beautiful stories, but at the end of the day, it had to have a kind of utility. It had to tell you something about the reasons why things happen, the reasons why you were as you are. And I think, in a way, that what I found in travelling to Ghana and seeing these kinds of stories was a different kind of history, a history that gave a sort of an emotional sustenance as opposed to just facts.
So when you read your grandfather's oral histories, what did you read about? What did they tell you?
Well, most of it was about land transference, because what they were trying to do in that period was to create a kind of history which was like the sort of history that we have here. You know, huge bodies of paper-based documentation that could verify that we were here, this is mine. And so what he was trying to do was to translate this kind of history, the oral history, into something that had a similar sort of weight in terms of courts and precedent and legal systems that the British might actually respond to. And so reading these things, I felt incredibly passionate. I'd never kind of read history and felt galvanised in the same way. And it made me, at this age, what, I was 18 or something, so I don't know, but I wanted to, it made me really passionate and really realised the power of history, that it wasn't kind of, you know, dry as dust, it wasn't just the retelling of stories, but this was something that, you know, it could reanimate things within you that were, you know, were really important.
So when you read your grandfather's oral histories and you first went to Ghana, were you aware then that there were sort of contested histories, that maybe that story didn't fit into a narrative that you've learnt previously?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that is accepted within these kinds of histories, is that there will be multiple accounts. And it is about the power of the narrator, as much as it isn't about verifying. It isn't about a kind of empirical history. This is about accepting that there are multiple perspectives on any single incident, and that history is something which is and should be contested. And in a way, what keeps it alive is that play and counterplay around narrative. And that is also why, rather than holding these kinds of objects in aspect, rather than putting them in archives or placing them behind glass, you use them. And so the records themselves that they are thumbed through, and the accreted damage and decay, is seen almost as being a kind of a mark of how they've been used and loved and respected. And I came to kind of understand that as being a different kind of history, and that I can remember speaking to an old uncle and him having many of these flags, and some of them were sort of riddled with termites and they were kind of disintegrating. He could tell from the look on my face that I was wondering why weren't they repaired, and why didn't he take them to the local museum and have a conservator look at them. But what he was saying is that, you know, this is how we show love in using them, in allowing them to live, and part of living is allowing something to die.
But it's very different, isn't it, from using paper records, if you're trying to come to a conclusion or extrapolate meaning. How do you do that when you're dealing with objects? And that's historians seem a lot more comfortable when they're dealing with the written word.
It's a different kind of process, and there is a sort of scary sort of dynamic in oral history in which it is always fluid. But I think if you have an acceptance of that, I think it can actually make very kind of complex but beautiful histories in which it's not about everything fitting together perfectly to try to tell a very flat linear narrative. It is about looking at the way in which history creates a kind of dialectic. It's constantly in tension. Narrative is constantly in tension with counter-narrative. And I think accepting that can actually create really fantastic history. And some of the best history in any tradition is actually, I think, made in that vein.
In your TV series, which you based your book on,
yes.
You use a lot of objects, don't you, to kind of unpack the history of the culture.
Yes.
I'd be interested to hear your experience of an example of an artifact that you found and what that told you about the history.
I mean, there were so many beautiful things and the sense of sort of privilege in being able to kind of get access to things was amazing. But I do remember we were in Ethiopia and we were looking at the story of those very early Christian churches. You know, if you think that this is a place where, in Yeha, in Ethiopia, that there is a form of Christianity that has its roots, you know, in the 6th century. I mean, this is absolutely fascinating. And the continuity of Christian practice is also something which is nigh on unrivaled. And we managed to get permission to climb a fairly kind of precariously up a rope which took us onto a plateau where one of the oldest churches in Ethiopia stands, which is more than 1,000 years old, in Debredamo. It's glorious up there. You can see literally for hundreds of miles in most directions. And living on the top are a number of monks, some of whom who have lived there for their entire lives and are now in their kind of 70s and 80s. And they practice a very austere but beautiful form of Ethiopian Christianity. But they have also invested over that time in an incredible body of literature. And one of the things that I saw there was a very, very ancient book of prayer. It gave a sense of how, you know, this is a period, this was created, a book created in a period when across Europe we weren't doing anything that rivaled the kind of beauty, sophistication, the illuminations on that manuscript that were very, very evident. And it was still being used, you know, on a weekly basis. But it gave a sense of how this was a discrete church. So much of African history that you get a sense of it, of people trying to find ways in which this was influenced either by trade from across the Indian Ocean, by influence of Mediterranean cultures. But this was something which was discreetly Ethiopian. So it gave a sense of how this parallel trajectory of very early Christianity was African. And it was enormously powerful. And yet at the same time, it was being animated by people today, that they believed in it and it made sense to them.
It's interesting that such an old document survived in those conditions, because obviously here at the archive we're always concerned with preserving the documents and we keep them at a very specific temperature, quite cool and without much light. So amazing that it survived that long.
Yes.
Why do you think that was? Do you have an idea? Or?
It might be that the book itself is ancient in the sense that it's been constantly under a state of repair.
Yeah.
But if you go to Timbuktu, where we started our conversation, that there are many archives that contain documents that are 1,000 years old, and not all of them are state-of-the-art buildings.
Yeah.
That those incredible earth-built buildings that are exquisite to look at, but also incredibly cool and dry within. And they have made wonderfully sophisticated repositories for these archives. And in the more distant past, that people would actually bury these documents.
Yeah.
And they seem to survive.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not saying that I would recommend it, but it is an interesting kind of way of thinking about preservation and conservation.
Now, I'm interested in coming back to this theme of history as being sort of not just one truth or one version of events. You say your interest in history was particularly stirred when you saw two versions of events jarring and not fitting together very obviously. Are there any examples in your book where you, try and write a misperception in your eyes?
Well, I think even more contemporary history, that travelling in South Africa and trying to tell the story post-apartheid of the Zulu, and it's enormously contested, and you go to sites that were fought over by the British and the Boers, or by the Zulus and the British, and you have multiple variations of interpretation of those, but also that you have, you know, like Addis Zandelwana, that you see stacks of white stones that mark the sites where the British fell. But for the Zulu, it's also become a place which is incredibly venerated. And it's interesting that it's through the history, that distant history, that they've actually managed to find a way to negotiate some of the more problematic things around their more recent history. But you go to those sites, and it's a kind of respect for the rival, discreet interpretations for each one of those different places that gives it a kind of power. It gives it a sense of how this state of South Africa might well be viable, that we can all have our different understandings, both of the place of history, what it means, of interpretation, and of the actual facts themselves, but at the same time that we can accept a kind of mutual respect. That made me feel incredibly heartened, and the powerful place of history for people. But also in somewhere like Uganda, where the history was almost systematically destroyed in the post-colonial period by a politics which was trying to unify people. And yet today, the people are trying to look back beyond it, to kind of put back very kind of small fragments of things to try to create a new kind of history. And what it is not doing is becoming a basis for division, but it's becoming something which I think is creating a sense of respect.
It's interesting to see that Gus has travelled for months and months with the filming of these the two series of Lost Kingdoms of Africa. Perhaps you could tell us, what was your experience of all this travelling and then trying to capture history in a way that would captivate a wider audience?
Yeah, we travelled a huge amount. As you say, these are large distances, and very often in places like Sudan, that many of the incredible Nubian kingdoms that were, 1,000 and 2,000 years ago, at their height, are today that they are in the middle of deserts. And so it meant travelling to very, very kind of remote places. And, you're working with, it's not glamorous, I can assure you that, you're working with tiny crews of people who you get to know very, very well. What I loved is the complete and utter dedication of each one of the different people that I was working with, both to their discrete discipline, but also to the wider project. Because even though this is just television, many of the African historians, and also the historians in Britain who helped us an awful lot as well, that they are beginning to make new discoveries, particularly with in terms of the archaeology, and also with new reinterpretation of archive materials. That meant that we could look in a completely new way at some of these sites, and that was just completely thrilling to get to some of these places that were incredibly remote. Working with historians who, literally were working on the archaeology, and were completely transforming our understanding of what these sites actually meant. It was, yeah, it was wonderful. It was glorious. And I would love to do other things that are equally rewarding, but I doubt, you know, that in such an intensive period that I'll be able to ever again.
And if you were going to choose one place that you went to that was most exciting, what would you
pick? Oh, gosh. I don't really have a particular place that I loved more than any other. But I think, for me, I think the thing that I found generally incredibly moving was that you are aware of the fragility of so much of the history, but also how hard people are fighting to keep it alive. And I saw that in so many places. I mean, Africa is transforming over the course of my lifetime, going to somewhere like Lagos and seeing it growing, and it is absolutely kind of it's awe-inspiring. There are people who are not just interested in the future. They're not just, there isn't just a headlong rush into tomorrow. There are also people who are really, really passionately trying to work to preserve and to rewrite the history. And the beautiful thing is that because they're doing it from an African perspective, that it just feels just incredibly heartening. You know, I was reduced to tears, but that was tears of happiness and relief, but just of feeling that this is history that is in very good hands.
And were there any surprises that you encountered while you were doing your research?
Oh, so many. I mean, I'm travelling in Sudan and telling that story of what I guess we might actually see as being kind of something like an Egyptian story, but telling it from the southern Danubian perspective. And you realise that perspective is everything. There are more pyramids in that bit of Sudan than there are actually in Egypt. And the story of that whole civilization is something that we know so little about. And yet these were people who were doing incredible things that rivaled their northern neighbours and actually enabled them to invade them and to take over and to run that whole area for a considerable period of time. And there are just so many of those histories that need to be told. I think we really have, one could do many, many series.
But then how did you boil down your experiences, fascinating and varied, into a book? How do you change something, transfer it from screen to paper? How did you approach that?
Well, if I hope some of you do read it, but it's not. I didn't try to tell just the story that you see on screen. But this is it's very kind. I tried to make it a personal story. I was kind of very interested in. I've read a lot of those Victorian travellers. I didn't want it to be like that, but I was interested in how Africa actually kind of can have a very profound effect on people, and that it actually challenged so many people's preconceptions about the continent. And so, in a way, it is a journey in which I travel, many, many tens of thousands of miles through some of the most beautiful places on earth. But it's also, it is an emotional and mental journey for me, in which I don't get closer necessarily to the history, but I feel a kind of, but I do kind of, my sense of respect of how people have fought over millennia to preserve it. I mean, it's something which grows, really profoundly.
And are you working on anything currently?
I am, yes, and I'm doing something, I adored doing that, and one of the things that I really enjoyed was the food, and that so much that you read about in terms of Africa is about the lack of food. But we ate incredibly well, and most people that we met, they seem to also, and that the cuisine in Africa is incredibly varied, complex, but also just wonderful. And what I didn't have a single negative interaction during my 2 years of travel. And what I wanted to write was something which was celebratory and very accessible. So I'm trying to shape something on food that looks at the history of the continent, but through a number of dishes. You know, I hope that it will be something that people enjoy, because you know, African food, I think, is very underrated.
So again, you're trying to correct a misperception, perhaps.
Yeah, well, and it is mine that, you know, I think on my first, the earliest trips to Africa, that I had fallen for the idea that, you know, don't eat the food type of thing, and I tried to avoid as much. And it was only actually after getting ill from eating tinned foods and things like that I did partake in that, and I thoroughly enjoyed it and realised what I'd been missing. And the variety and the complexity and the sophistication of the cuisines is—it's something, you know. It really is something to behold. So I hope that that's something that people would enjoy.
So, is there an African food that you can suggest that our audience try that they might be able to get hold of?
Well, I think there's one that's very, that you probably will be able to get hold of, but also I think if you think about the Mali situation, that one that is enjoyed very much in Mali is a jollof rice, which is rice cooked with meat, but also that the rice is made red by a mixture of pepper and tomato, and it is completely gorgeous. So if you get the chance,
we've been told. So sort of turning to you more as a writer rather than specifically looking at your book, when you were writing The Lost Kingdoms of Africa, did you have a writing routine? Could you give the audience a bit of an insight into your day?
Me as a model. No, I have a young daughter, and I live in a small flat. So the only time in which I could find that it was quiet was actually at night. So I would get up about 4 in the morning and I would write. But a lot of that was actually written in the back of cars and you know, around firesides and things during the evenings after filming. But when I got home, I would, you know, I did spend time in archives, checking things, making sure that the actual kind of the underlying narrative was robust. But what I wanted from that book is something which was a pleasure to read. You know, it's where this begins, that the flag has to be beautiful, the story has to be beautiful, because it's embellishing a history that is worthy of real respect. And I was wanting to write a history, a story that was in some way worthy of this incredible privilege of travelling, I don't know what I think it was equivalent to 2 circuits of the earth driving on African roads and meeting glorious people, seeing unbelievably beautiful things, you know, almost on a daily basis. The most profound memory of it being about people trying to tell stories. So with that in mind, I wanted to make sure that my story was beautiful.
Of course, so beautiful stories, that's the bar. So were there any authors that particularly inspired you, or their style that you maybe sought to emulate?
It is returning to the stories that I'd heard as a child. I mean, the reason that we, in part, study history is because there are lessons to be learned from history, and that some of them might be subtle. Part of it, I guess, is hoping that we as a race, that we grow. And what I wanted to attempt to do was to use the kinds of historical methodologies that are used in Africa, that is about, in part, of course, trying to find a sort of a truth of a history that works. But it is also about believing in a kind of beauty of narrative. And so I was very keen that the stories, the histories, that they told us something about the place, about the time, but they also told us something about the culture, the way in which people hold stories.
Is there a book that you wish that you'd written?
so many. I mean, I genuinely don't feel like... I've done so many things in my career that I don't feel like I'm a writer. What I've tried to do here is to reflect some of my passions. And there is so much that I do have to learn. So I wouldn't know where to start. There are so many that, you know, I kind of bow down to. I mean, the process of turning kind of facts that you find in archives that people tell you into something, it's not just into something which is fluid, but something which can be sort of, you know, suspenseful, interesting, and at the same time giving insight, so that it's a very great skill, and it's one that, you know, I'm trying to acquire, but I'm very much kind of, you know, at the very beginning of my journey there.
So when you were getting up at 4 a.m, very dedicated to write your manuscript, what were there any particular sort of practical difficulties you encountered with bringing the book together?
There are those difficulties that I guess are incredibly vivid for anyone who's writing, particularly social history in Africa, the sort of history of kingdoms that I've tried to construct. And that is trying to balance or trying to weight it so that you can still have the sort of richness of the oral content, but at the same time have a kind of historical narrative which is continuous and believable. And where there are kind of rival takes on any particular thing, that it's that you can balance them and be conscious about it so that you... Because it's... In so many places where the history is written by the victors, where there is only oral history as remaining, that it is then very difficult to get a kind of a rounded sense of what might have occurred. And so it is both trying to find balance, but also offering context as a
sort of for that micro history.
Exactly. To try and make it rich, real, and because so much African history, it can feel almost like you're reading about people who live on Alpha Centauri, and it's the idea that these are people like you and I. And I do think the very best histories that they make the main protagonists feel like you could reach out and touch them. And there are, because of oral history, there are those kinds of... There is that sort of personal body of information about people from history. And if you look at... You go to the British Museum and you look at the Benin bronzes, and you can see a whole kind of, you know, tableau from the Benin court history that are very, very rich and vivid. And then there is written documentation that can animate some of that as well. And you begin to realise how these things aren't incompatible. You can actually map one against the other. And it's trying to make one not feel like an illustration of the other, but trying to sort of form a balance between the two.
That's wonderful. So I've got one final question, and that is... For any aspiring authors in the audience, do you have any tips on the basis of writing this book? You know, pitfalls to avoid or things that you'd recommend?
Gosh. It is like swimming the channel, and I think that, you know, without support, that you do, you know, for the first, well, at least for me, that I went off like a rocket, you know, thinking, I'm just going to really kind of, you know, do this as quickly and as painlessly as possible. And then...
Painless that can be at 4 a.m.
Yeah. I do enjoy the process of writing, but I did hit a wall, there was a point about 2/3 of the way through where I would have done anything other than type another word. And you then do start to have doubt about yourself and about the process and about the worthwhile nature of the whole project, and then you do need other people you do need to try and recall the reasons why you began. It may well be that you're kind of close to finishing, but the final chapters, if you actually find yourself in that state, can be incredibly painful. You know, overcoming that is almost as satisfying as the chapters that you produce almost effortlessly. But then for me, that last bit was incredibly tough, but there was a day when, you know, I daren't sort of look up ahead because I kind of kept thinking, God, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to stop doing it. But there was a day when they handed me this huge package of proofs, and I looked at it and they had the illustrations in it, and suddenly it looked like a book. This thing that had been kind of felt like it had been suckling on me and had felt like almost like a weight, it had decoupled itself, and it was a thing in itself. There are very few times that I've kind of felt that sense of yes, thank God, now it's out there running around free, and I hope it brings pleasure to some people. But
Well, I hope this is an account of what it's like to be an author hasn't
Oh, yes, don't
put
slip your wrist.
if we could put our hands together to thank Gus for
this talk was recorded on the 12th of February 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This talk was sponsored by the Friends of the National Archives. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.